It's a new year, so how to make the most of it? Heather Havrileski will join us to talk about two new books she reviews on our cover. Amy Cuddy's Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges, and Year of Yes by Shonda Rhimes.
We're constantly asked to sort of put ourselves forward, and both of these books kind of point to the disconnect between what's expected of us and what we can actually reasonably achieve as basic, flawed, neurotic human beings that we are.
What happens when you lose your belly button? Michael Ian Black will be here to talk about his new book, Navel Gazing, True Tales of Bodies, Mostly Mine, But Also My Mom's, which I know sounds weird.
The richness of love is about embracing the flaws as much as it is embracing the things that are lovely about the person. I'm probably as close to perfection as a man can get, but even I have flaws.
This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Heather Havrileski joins us now from L.A. She reviews two books on our cover this week. The first is Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges by Amy Cuddy, and Year of Yes, How to Dance It Out, Stand in the Sun, and Be Your Own Person by Shonda Rhimes. Heather, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Pamela. I'm thrilled to be here.
I feel like I should like get up and dance just citing those titles. It's a very New Year's-y kind of positive, proactive energy.
They're very in line with the current moment of inspiring books. It's interesting because Shonda Rhimes, in her book Year of Yes, actually talks about the woman who tells you to pose like Wonder Woman, talks about Amy Cuddy's TED Talk. So they very much are one of a piece, kind of.
And who doesn't want to be Shonda Rhimes at least a little bit these days?
I know. Well, the nice thing about Shonda Rhimes is that she not only has been so successful, obviously, as a showrunner and producer and creator of all these kind of blockbuster, very, very, very popular shows. I mean, her book is incredibly humble and conversational, and it's a kind of almost like folksy, filled with folksy kind of writing that I usually don't like, but she's so charming and so sort of self-deprecating and funny and so honest that the book is great.
It's interesting, that idea that it used to be with a self-help book, right, or an inspirational book, where women think that you'd have to be kind of some icon of perfection to inspire people. But both of these books come from, at least sort of on the part of the author, an origin of insecurity.
There's definitely a trend in current self-help that's sort of all about vulnerability and showing your flaws and accepting your flaws. I'm an advice columnist, and I'm part of that whole thing. I'm all about sticking your neck out and taking risks and also just accepting that you'll probably bungle half the risks you take.
That inside you're just a loser.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is I think that the whole kind of trend towards, you know, embracing your imperfections is actually just a reaction to the self-help movement that kind of came before that said, keep on striving, live your best life, just perpetually move towards some slick, polished goal. And also, that something I point out at the beginning of my piece, the world is really changing. And those of us, especially writers and almost anyone in any field, academics, my husband's an academic, we all have to be such polished, presentable human beings now. We're asked to do podcasts like this one, for example. In the old days, you could just disappear into your office and never come out as a writer. And now, so many professions, we're asked to present ourselves as if we are presenters, as
right.
if we're anchor people, as if we're gurus, as if we have it all together. And I think the pressure that comes from that expectation of looking good, you know, there's online video, there are events, people have speaking agents,
right.
the rise of podcasting. We're constantly asked to sort of put ourselves forward. And both of these books kind of point to the disconnect between what's expected of us and what we can actually reasonably achieve as basic, flawed, neurotic human beings that we are.
But it's interesting because it really starts now before your professional life begins with adolescents and even preteens who have to present this kind of Instagrammable self as opposed to being able to like go home and, you know, put on their like night brace and, you know, zit cream and sweatshirt and not be seen by anyone.
It's interesting because I'm also reading Marie Kondo's book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, which is the kind of a giant sensation about reorganizing your life. And I just got to the section where she says, you should not own loungewear. Like, you don't retire your clothes and then just say, well, I'll wear them at home, because your self-image is affected by how you dress at home. I read that and I thought, uh-oh.
You know? I was going to say.
I mean, these two books to me feel like a reaction to that. On the one hand, both books sort of embrace this idea that here's how you do it. You have to say yes to the world and face your challenges, get your life in order. But on the other hand, there's this feeling of part of being able to do that means accepting your authentic self and deciding what that authentic self is. If your authentic self is a soft pants, sweatpants wearing self, then you have to embrace that too, kind of.
All right, let's go back to that idea of vulnerability, because I think, again, from the outside, it's hard to imagine Shonda Rhimes feeling vulnerable. But where does she start before this year of yes?
She explains that essentially she's been saying no to everything. At some point, she's telling her sister, she's standing around with her sister, and she's telling her sister all the things that she's been invited to do, events, conferences, talk shows, and how she just keeps saying no to all these things. She doesn't want to do any of these things. And her sister says, you never say yes to anything. She just mutters this under her breath. Shonda Rhimes is this type A obsessive workaholic, self-admitted control freak. And when she hears this, her reaction is, you know, she wakes up in the middle of the night and she thinks about how true it is. All of a sudden she realizes that she's been hiding, even though she has all the success in her life. You know, actually, her life is sort of going off the rails in private. She's not that happy. She's gained a lot of weight. Being a Hollywood showrunner, anecdotally, it seems like it's extremely hard for the rest of your life not to fall apart, because the hours that are demanded of you are crazy. And she's running 3 different shows at this point when her sister says this. So she basically decides, she resolves to start saying yes to every single thing that comes her way. And that includes speaking at her alma mater, Dartmouth, which she is so fearful of doing. I mean, she describes in really beautiful detail just how afraid she is of speaking in front of people. She goes into very explicit detail about how she's going to go on Jimmy Kimmel and fall and crack her head on the side of his desk, and she's going to poop her pants in front of a crowd at Dartmouth. You sort of come out of the gate with this feeling like, God, you know, I'm not the only person who feels this way. You know, I'm not the only one who feels like, I can't do that. It'll end in disaster. I'm not ready for the world. And she sort of goes through all these different stages of saying, basically forcing herself to do things that are totally uncomfortable for her. And she comes out of it as a feeling like a completely new person. It's very interesting because it's just this sort of private revelation that she has that she then turns around and shares. At the beginning of the book, I thought, this is one of those stunt books. Shonda Rhimes walked into someone called Shonda Rhimes and said, write any book. Just tell us what book you want.
Right.
There was a time when you would get these kinds of calls where people would talk to writers and say, what if you only wear green all year?
I know. What if you go back to high school?
Yeah, go back to high school. Tell us how it goes. So I was suspicious that maybe this book would come across that way. It was very obvious throughout the book that she privately resolved to follow this program of saying yes to everything. And all these different things came out of it. She lost a lot of weight. She started to say yes to friends. She started to be more present with people, which she realized she hadn't been doing. She started to say yes every time. She has a resolution to every time her kids say, do you want to play? She says yes, which that alone was, as a mother, I thought, how do you do that?
I know, that impressed me.
Yes, but she rightfully points out, you know, kids actually only need about 15 minutes, you know, like you play with them for 15 minutes and then they get bored and they wander off and want to do something else. You know, the nice thing about her is every step along of the way, she says, look, I have a great nanny. Obviously, I'm not a magician. People are running my life and helping me every step of the way with everything I do. And she reminds the reader of that. You basically end up rooting for her. You know, she's doing a photo shoot at the end of the book, and it's very kind of rarefied, precious, very successful people situations. But you end up rooting for her because she's so frank and honest about her experience of these things that you just, you know, you want her to succeed. You're like, yes,
Go, Shonda Rhimes. All right. I want to talk about, you mentioned that she finds that she's more present. And given that the title of the other book is Presence, let's talk about that. Who is Amy Cuddy, the author?
Amy Cuddy is a social psychologist at Harvard. She suffered a brain injury when she was very young that basically made it, she was in college, it made it so that it took her years to finish college, and she never knew if she was going to be able to do anything she wanted to do. She worked really hard to become an academic, but all along she had imposter syndrome. She felt that she didn't belong, that people were going to suddenly discover, you don't belong here, you're not one of us. At some point, she had a really good advisor who told her, you do belong, yes, you have to just believe, listen, you just have to act like you belong until you feel like you belong, basically. So she took that advice, and then she had a grad student working for her who basically admitted to her, I'm not doing well because I feel like I don't belong here. I feel like I'm tricking everyone into thinking that I belong here, but I don't really. And she told the grad student, listen, you're going to do what I did. You're going to pretend you belong until you belong. And something about that experience inspired her to think about what is presence? What does it mean to behave like someone who thinks that they belong or believes that they belong? What does it mean to present your authentic self to other people? One of the things that she found was people who are authentic and present often hold their bodies in a certain way. If you want to be perceived as authentic and present, if you want to feel more present, if you want other people to perceive you as powerful, you actually can simply hold your body in a certain way and you will come across as powerful, even if inside you're just the same neurotic, powerless feeling person that you ever were. So they tested this out in numbers of ways. I think, generally speaking, I don't love books that are packed with social psychology research. My dad was an econ professor, and when I was young, he said to me, you can do anything you want with your life, just don't go into the social sciences, whatever you do. And when I read these books, I kind of think about that. I'm reminded, like, it's just a very current thing to just pack your entire nonfiction book, your bestseller, you know, your hopeful bestseller, with just one study after the other. And I do think that's the weak part of this book, the studies get a little bit repetitive. But actually, it's a really interesting book because it looks kind of dry based on the cover. It looks a little bit like just another academic book filled with research. But when you sit down and read it, it sort of reminds you what it means to show up and be present with other people and how that feels. Amy Cuddy is a great writer. I've watched her TED Talk. I wasn't like amazed with the TED Talk, or it's like the second most popular TED Talk ever, I think.
Why do you think it was? What do you think did that?
She's a good presenter, and it's an interesting subject, I think, that everyone is fascinated by at this particular time. It's sort of like, how do you go and, you know, act like you know what you're doing? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have a lot of neuroticism for numbers of reasons, social media being one of them, the pressures of jobs being so kind of having so many different elements to them these days. You can't just hide in a closet, like I said before. The timing was just right. It answered a need in the public. And also, Amy Cuddy breaks down and cries towards the end, and it's really very, very moving. You know, it's also totally apparent that the audience is really moved by the talk. They all give her a standing ovation, and they all look like they have tears in their eyes. And it's, you know, the book is, I think, even more effective than the talk. It's extremely well written. The first three chapters are just very inspiring, and everything she says makes intuitive sense. You end up with this feeling that, God, that's the key. You go out there and you fake it till you become it. You just charge out there and act like the person you essentially want to be. It sounds a little bit more like a trick than it is. And she kind of says that. It's like you're doing this strange little trick of the mind in order to kind of occupy your body more. And as a result, you will find that you listen to people more. You know, you're actually more present. So it's sort of like you fake something, but then you actually are more authentic as a result of the faking.
All right. Well, Heather, you've motivated me to fake it and to say yes to everything. I don't know what those two together will bring.
You already say yes to everything, Pamela. I don't think you're in trouble there.
Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was really nice to talk to you.
Heather Havrileski reviews two books this week on our cover, Year of Yes, How to Dance It Out, Stand in the Sun and Be Your Own Person by Shonda Rhimes, and Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges by Amy Cuddy. Michael Ian Black joins us now from Connecticut to talk about his new memoir, Navel Gazing, True Tales of Bodies, Mostly Mine, But Also My Mom's, which I know sounds weird. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
How'd I do with that subtitle? Did I do the proper intonations?
I think you did very well because you didn't try to sell it too hard. You just sort of said it. And I think in just saying it, it's probably at its funniest, which isn't to say it's funny at all, but I hope it is.
Speaking of not selling, the blurb from Ricky Gervais is, Michael Ian Black asked me if I would provide a quote for his book, and I said that I would. You edited that for style, right?
No, that's exactly what he wrote.
That's pretty brilliant. So this is your third book.
Third and a half. I also wrote one with Meghan McCain.
So you wrote a memoir, which has one of my favorite titles ever, You're Not Doing It Right.
Thanks.
And then My Custom Van and 50 other mind-blowing essays that will blow your mind all over your face. And now you're going to have to tell me the title of the half book.
The half book is called America, You Sexy Bitch.
How did you get into writing books?
Well, first of all, for your listeners who have no idea who I am, I'm a comedian and actor and writer of things other than books. And one of my life goals has always been to write a book, singular. I sort of thought, I want to write a book one day, as most people, I think, certainly most New York Times podcast listeners think to themselves at one point or another, I'd like to write a book. And I thought, well, I have no idea how to write a book, and I don't know if I'm capable of writing a book, which is why my first book, My Custom Van and 50 Other Mind-Blowing Essays That Will Blow Your Mind All Over Your Face, is a collection of sort of short comedic essays, almost monologues, which was really in my wheelhouse. And I didn't want to write my first book like that, but I didn't know how else to approach it. I didn't know how else to write. And then the second book, You're Not Doing It Right, I really wanted to create a cohesive narrative, and I didn't know if I could do that either. And so each book for me has really just been about teaching myself how to write more than anything else. I mean, that's my main goal with writing books, is to become a better writer.
I'm still a little bit stuck on the idea that you acted but what you really wanted to do was write, because I feel like everyone else, you know, like writes, but what they really want to do is act, or waitresses.
The thing is, like, I came up in sketch comedy, and so acting and writing are so inextricably linked in that world, because in order to perform, you have to write, at least in my sketch group, The State, because whoever wrote the thing was in charge of casting the thing, and so you would cast yourself, because that's the kind of assholes that we were. So it was kind of like, if you want to eat, you have to work. It was sort of like that. So writing and acting are sort of the same, opposite sides of the same coin,
right,
for me. And the acting side just sort of found more success earlier first than the writing side. And I still haven't really found success in the writing side.
Is there a divide among comedians between those comedians who are just funny and those comedians who write and do their own acting?
Right. There's a lot of funny actors who generally perform other people's material. But in the world of stand-up and sketch comedy, almost 100% of those people write their own stuff.
And is there a divide?
No, not really. Because even comedic actors, I'm thinking now of somebody like Paul Rudd, who is super funny. They improvise a lot on set, and now Paul has actually moved into writing. He co-wrote Ant-Man. So I wouldn't say there's a divide, no.
He really wants to be a writer, too.
Oh, he's such a poser.
But what's interesting about this book and your previous memoir, You're Not Doing It Right, is that, I mean, I guess there's a subgenre, the comedian memoir, but these books aren't just comedy.
No, not at all. And, you know, I hate the fact that I am in show business at all when I write my books, because my books have nothing to do with show business. They have nothing to do with career. I'm not interested in those as topics. And I worry about getting lumped in with, I mean, I know I get lumped in with the kind of comedian memoir, and there's nothing wrong with those books, but that's not really what I'm doing. I'm not necessarily trying to be all funny all the time. I'm trying to really write a truthful book. And there's jokes in it, but that's just because that's kind of who I am and how I write.
But honesty, that effort towards honesty comes through, I think, in both books. That kind of you're constantly sort of setting up a pose and then exposing it and then exposing that.
Yeah, and that's purposeful, both because I am interested in getting at the truth of things and in digging as deep as I'm capable of digging, which may not be that deep, but I'm trying to get at truths. And then, you know, the humor is hopefully comes out of those truths. And a lot of the humor is self-deprecating. I mean, I'm not trying to put other people down in the book. I mean, I feel like in any of my books, I feel like ultimately the joke is on me most of the time.
You're just trying to put yourself down.
Yeah, well, I'm good at that.
So the first memoir was about romantic relationships. It was about marriage. What's this book about?
It's about family and, I mean, it says in the title, bodies, which is true. It traces my mother's history, specifically her series of illnesses she's been dealing with for the last 15 years. And then sort of running parallel to that is my own sort of story of my incipient demise after turning 40. So it's about bodies, much the way Ta-Nehisi Coates' book is about bodies, except not at all.
Right. I was waiting for that. I allowed the beat there.
I'm trying to put us in the same class, assuming your readers will, your listeners will fall for it.
For readers of Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, enjoy navel gazing. So on the face of it, the first book about romantic relationships, marriage, the second memoir about aging, family illness. Was this less fun to write?
Well, they're always less fun to write. I mean, you know, there's so much effort into making them seem light and fun, but they're a disaster to write. They're horrible. You know, it's such an exertion. I don't think of myself as somebody who has very many gifts. I don't find myself naturally funny. I don't find myself a naturally good writer. Like, I have to work pretty hard to accomplish anything. And the books are certainly no different. I probably have to work harder at the books than I do at anything else. I mean, every writer bitches about how hard it is to write books, and it is. It's terrible. It's a terrible thing to do for little to no reward. And yet we do it. Why? I have no idea.
Because it's so much better paying than acting.
Yeah, it really is. No, I mean, there's just something very satisfying about getting a book in the mail that you've written, and you put it on your bookshelf next to a couple other books that you've written, and then you totally forget about it.
You start off the book with your mother's belly button. And then where do you go? Tell us about that.
The first sentence of the book is, my mother has no belly button, which is a statement of fact, because during one of her many surgeries, they had to essentially take out her belly button, and then they didn't replace it because there's no reason to replace the belly button. It's just sort of, I thought, a kind of funny and poignant thing that you would lose something so kind of superfluous in a way, but also like literally the thing that makes us a mammal, you know what I mean, is your belly button and the way that you are raised in utero. And then it also plays with the title of the book, obviously, navel gazing. And then it goes from there. I mean, it traces, as I said, my mom's illnesses, starting with her diagnosis of uterine cancer about 15 years ago. And since then, it's just been a sort of slow and steady decline in her health. And it's been a nightmare for her and, you know, less so for us who love her, but also terrible for us. Yeah, it's a hard thing to deal with. And I wanted to write about my mom because she's had a challenging life. She outed herself as a lesbian when I was 5 or 6. She divorced my dad and got involved with this other woman and who she was with for 17 years, who was just, I call her a rage addict in the book. And that's, I think, an apt description. So she was in this, and we were in this kind of abusive home life that I was raised in. Her parents brought her in to the hospital when she was about 18 or 19 years old and gave her, or basically forced her to have electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, because they thought she might be gay. And at the time, my mom didn't believe herself to be gay, but her parents did and gave her shock treatments, which essentially erased her memory from, you know, childhood and up until that point. I wanted to tell her story. You know, it's a challenging story, and it's a challenging story to make funny. And she was great about it. I mean, she's been really supportive of the book and of my efforts. And I don't paint her in the most flattering colors all the time because it was important to me that she be presented as a real person with real flaws. And so that's what I'm trying to do in addition to telling my own story. And I have no problem pointing out my own flaws, which I do repeatedly throughout the book.
Well, it gets back to that effort at honesty, almost like a hyper-honesty.
Yeah, because I have a real repulsion when books about loved ones, in the case of my previous book, my wife, in this book, my mom, when they almost canonize their subjects, because I think it does a disservice to the subject. Nobody in our lives is without flaw. And to me, the richness of love is about embracing the flaws as much as it is embracing the things that are lovely about the person. It's true with my wife. It's true with my mom. I know it's true with people who love me. I'm probably as close to perfection as a man can get, but even I have flaws, Pamela.
An unexpected revelation there. But one of your not flaws is your kind of multi-hyphenate status, writer, comedian, actor. And I want to add to that podcast host. I'm not even sure if it's legal for a podcast host to interview another podcast host. And
legal and encouraged.
And most recently, the lead anecdote in a New Yorker story.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That has not made its way onto my IMDb page yet. Yeah, the story of Megan Phelps Roper, who is the granddaughter of Fred Phelps, the founder of the Westboro Baptist Church, with whom I started communicating on Twitter early in both of our Twitter careers. And I think she kind of credits me with helping her take the very first baby step towards renouncing her family's church and hate mongering. So yeah, she mentioned me in that article.
I think then I should also add Twitter onto your list of credentials.
But it's all of a piece, you know what I mean? Like, I don't really consider myself a multi-hyphenate, and I don't even really like the term because it makes me feel like a dilettante, which I am. And so I don't like feeling
like being exposed.
I don't like it being pointed out that I am a jack of all trades and master of none.
All right. I want to go back one last question about the book, because as you said, it is so much about your mother. But your mother was also in the first book. And I'm curious if you felt that after writing that there was something about her that you wanted to go back to, or if that just arose naturally because of her illness and the themes that touched on.
Well, both. I mean, I felt like I didn't go far enough into my relationship with her in You're Not Doing It Right, because it wasn't really the subject of the book. The themes of that book, which were kind of romantic love and taking a look back at your life and sort of trying to figure out how you got to the place where you are, I felt like I sort of addressed half of my life in that book, and the other half I wanted to address in this book. And then her illness, or illness, I don't know, kind of provided a natural narrative for this book in addition to things that were going on in my own life.
And I guess brings us back to the title, because the navel is really the connection between a child and a mother.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of that until this very moment when you pointed it out, and now I feel like an idiot in addition to a dilettante.
I'm here to help you with your book tour.
Thanks.
All right, Michael Ian Black, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.